Ladies and gentlemen, Dave Al from London.
Hi, my name's David, and I'm forward. Oh, it's really good. Thanks for asking me to come and speak. It's really a pleasure to be of service to me. I love Switzerland anyway. I go to Zurich quite a lot. It's just an amazing country, really. Not as good as the country I was born in, of course, Scotland. I was born in Scotland. I grew up there. I grew up in an alcoholic family. My father is one of us. Quite a violent home. My father left when I was 8 years old. There's a couple of episodes. One, he chased me around the garden and tried to kill me with an axe. And another one where he threw a garden right through a window. And today I know that that was resentment because I loved my mother's side of the family more than his. I didn't know that time growing up as a kid. And it was quite a violent place to grow up. You know, I remember times he drove his car home, smashed his car up, and I watched my sister with a little tea set dip cloths in water and cut to cover the blood in his face. I remember seeing this as a kid, and my mum was quite badly bruised a lot of the time. I remember sitting in bars in London drinking, telling people these stories so they feel sorry for me. And today I'm actually grateful that I went through that and went through that life. Because I won't be who I am or what I am today without it. And I grew up in that sort of family, and then my mother remarried and married somebody else who was probably one of us. I don't really know if he was, but probably. And he was quite violent as well. And I left home, and I ended up going through social services and being put into what was classed as supported lodgings. And I was under the care of social services. And they put me into social care with a lady who was one of us. And I spent a year of living, watching her bring other men home and different things. And I never really wanted to drink. You know, I watched what drinking done in my family home. I watched what it did with this lady. And I just watched it. Scotland's quite a mental place around the bars when you're a kid, you know. Like, there's just everybody's fighting all the time, and there's always rows between the football. And I just always saw it as a bad thing. And I never wanted to drink. And there was a few occasions where drinking was a possibility for me, and I didn't take it. You know, and I remember, I so related to the sharing today about the teething. You know, I remember my grandmother when I was a young kid rubbing whiskey on my gums when I was a little baby. I remember it very clearly. And anyway, I got to 12 years old, and as we do, I was unraveling everywhere. You know, I was shy, I couldn't speak to the girls, everybody else was having sort of parties. Everybody was seemed to join in things. And I was behind a school disco, and somebody said, "Do you want to have a drink?" And I remember very clearly taking a bottle of Old English cider and taking a swig of it, and my whole world changed. It literally changed. I can remember it like it was yesterday. I came from this little shy boy, all of a sudden being going into the disco and dancing and talking to the girls. It was just amazing. And I think my whole drinking career, I chased that moment back again. And I never, ever, ever, ever once got it back. You know, I drank, and I only know this today, I drank to have that moment back. That moment where it was okay, you know, where everything just seemed right. And this is going to Alcoholics. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I heard people sharing that they just drank to get out of it, and they just drank to get to blackout. They had to get to blackout as quick as possible. And I just remember in my drinking career, I hated blackouts. Because I wake up in the morning, I'm like, shit, what have I done? Where have I been? Who have I called? I just wanted to feel right. That moment that I had when I took that first drink, I just wanted to feel that again. And from that moment on, when I took that first drink, it wasn't like I drank all the time. It wasn't like I drank at weekends. It was never really planned, but I know I wanted to do it again. And I know I wanted to get that feeling again. And probably around 15, I had a homebrewing kit that I kept under my bed, and I made my own beer. And when that ran out, I used to go into the local shops and steal stuff. You know, I was cunning and baffling and very powerful as a kid. There was a lady in a newsagent shop, and I used to go in there all the time. And my mother's side of the family was quite a respectable family in a small village that I came from, and people sort of trusted me. And she used to go out the back, and I used to fill my school bag with all the sweets and all the latest comics and cigarettes, and then take them to school and sell them. And I was just like the best person to be around. I had everything always. Whatever anybody wanted, I had it. And it gave me the money to allow myself to drink. I think through the children's home, I spent 2 years from 14 to 16 in a children's home, and that was just amazing. You know, again, it was a thing that later on in life I was to sit in a bar and I would say to people that I had been in a children's home and what a bad life I'd had. And actually, it was amazing. I was able to do what I like. I drank, you could smoke in there, there was girls in there. It's the first time I learned about what you do with girls. I was 14 years old in this children's home. We used to like get out of bed at night and we'll wait till the staff were asleep, and then it was just all over the place, drinking and cigarettes and, you know, the other stuff that happens. And it was just an absolute ball, you know. I just loved every minute of it, really. You know, my drink grew all the way through. And then what happened is at 17, at 16 years old, I left the children's home because I thought I was a man, and I signed myself out. And this, I remember the staff sitting down with me saying, you know that you're going to have to pay your own way now. You know you probably have to get a job, you've got nowhere to live. And I just thought, but I'm 16, I'm a man. And I left the children's home. I remember walking just round the corner and thinking, what have I done? You know, I'm all alone. And what I did is I joined a group of people just like me. And I stayed in a farm barn for about 6 months and slept in a car for a little while. And I remember when I stayed in this barn, I had hardly any clothes. I never had really any money. And I used to go and pick potatoes to get extra money to go drinking. And I remember I used to have to make sure that my clothes were all smart when I went to the pub. I was around 16, 17 then. And I remember going to the farmhouse, and I used to have to iron it. Because when I went to the bar, I wanted to make sure my money was all fresh and crisp. And I used to sit in the bar, and all the other kids my age were sitting, like, playing football outside, or were running around with the girls. And I remember looking outside those glass windows in the bar, thinking they ain't got a clue. You know what I mean? And I really thought sitting with old men in a smoky, dirty pub was just the most amazing fun that anybody could have. And I used to sit in there and just look at it, thinking that everybody's missing out on something. There's something really special happening here. And like I say, I hung around with people that were very much like me. And as a kid growing up, I wanted to be this little gangster sort of person. And I really didn't have that in my heart. I didn't like fighting, I didn't like trouble, didn't like any of that stuff. But I wanted to be this little sort of Glasgow hard man, really, that you see and hear about. And at 17 years old, I worked in a bar as a bouncer. I was like about 8 stone. The rest of the bouncers had F off tattooed under their lips, and they were those type of people. And really all I was somebody went around and collected the glasses. Well, I thought I was a bouncer, and I had a nice white shirt with a black bow tie, and I used to drink with these people. And then one night what happened was, one night we were sitting drinking, and I'd had a few drinks, and they were all absolutely plastered. And somebody had to drive home, and they were talking about driving home, and I said, well, I'll drive. You know what I mean? I'd driven a tractor once on a farm. And the next thing I remember is going down onto the freeway, the wrong way, where you're meant to come up, onto ongoing traffic, and spinning into the central reservation. And I remember the police coming, and I said I was driving and my ribs were sore where I hit the steering wheel. And the type of people I was with, the police thought that I probably wasn't driving, and these people were threatening me to take responsibility for it. And after about maybe 15 minutes with the police, I thought, that's not a bad idea then. Maybe I wasn't driving. And the police said to me, look, we'll protect you. You can have a new identity. I thought, that's really cool. So I said, okay, I wasn't driving. And I remember going to court. I remember the fear that drove me, because these weren't really nice people from Scotland, and the fear that drove me and drove me and drove me all the way to that court appearance. And stood in court and told them that he was driving. And Sunday went down for that. And the rest of my life was fueled with the fear of that. And that was why I went to London. Mm-hmm. I went to London and I set up a new life. And it was funny, I arrived in London from a little country town in Scotland. And I remember getting to Victoria Station and everybody's running around as they do. If you've been to London, everything's just mad. And I'm like looking around all lost like a little boy. And I remember these Australians that had come to visit. And Australian people used to come to Scotland, go to London, they were all traveling. And I remember them telling stories in the bar about they were going to travel, and they were going to go to India, and they were going to go to all these wonderful countries. And I remember them saying that they were going to Ballon, and that was the next place. I thought, I'll go to Ballon. So I'm looking for the bus. And I get a bus, and I eventually get to Ballon. But the first place I do when I get to Ballon in London is to find the nearest pub. So I walk into the bar, and I order a drink, and the barman says to me, you want to drink in the bar down the road? I'm thinking, why are you saying that to me? And I said, why do I want to drink in a bar down the road? And he said, well, there's a lot of Scottish guys that run the bar down the road. So I went, okay. So I left my drink, and I ran down the road to this bar. These were guys from my town, my village, in Scotland. And I didn't go any further. That's where I ended up. I ended up living there, working there, drinking there, having the time of my life. And I still had this constant fear that every time I had a car pull up beside me, or every time somebody walked in who looked a bit wrong type of person, that they were coming for me. And I carried it all my life, you know, all the way right through into alcoholism. And I got married very early. Her mother was an alcoholic. I met this girl, and she had a little baby who was about 3 months old. And I thought, I didn't really think at the time consciously this will fix me, but that's what it was. That if I could just have this little family and somewhere to live, everything will sort of be okay. And so I got married, and I remember walking down the aisle thinking, what the hell am I doing? And looking to the left-hand side of me and seeing all my family there and thinking, I've got to go through with it. And I stayed married to her for 10 years. You know, I had two of my own children. My drinking really took off. I started a business that was very successful, and I was pretty young in my early 20s, and I had everything, you know. And what happened was I decided that now that I've got everything and I am everything, that I'll just go and play golf and drink and watch my business slowly dwindle away. And I got to a place in my life where my business had gone, everything had gone, the inland revenue were after me, I was drinking all the time, and I was in a really bad state. And a friend of mine that I'd played golf with rang me up one day and said, look, can you come and do some work for me? And I went driving limousines and driving people up to London in cars while they got drunk, and then come back just to have enough money to drink. I didn't care about feeding the children, paying the rent, doing all the things that, all this stuff that I'd lost. And so I just drank all the money that I had. And then one day he rang me and he said, look, I need you to drive a car on a funeral. I was like, I ain't driving no car on somebody's funeral. You know what I mean? I said, oh, I can't do that. And anyway, I go out because he helped me, and I drive a car on a funeral. And a year later, I'm one of the most highly paid funeral directors in all of Great Britain. I'm very well sought after because I have a drive, and I was drinking, and I've got this drive. And then, but a year after that, I do a funeral for this big wealthy family, and decide that one of the daughters is probably a good reason to leave my wife, and I manipulate her because it's all about if I get hot, I can have the money, I can start my business again, I can do this, I can do that, and do that. And I left my wife, and not that I would say that I loved her, it was the fact of I watched my little boy. I remember the day I walked away, and she threw my bags downstairs because I'd been caught for what I was doing. And I remember the look on his face. And then I remember my life. And it just rocketed me. My drinking just really took off. And I carried on working. And everything on the outside seemed to be okay. And inside I was dying. And then I enter Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't want to come here because I've heard stories. You know, I hadn't seen my father since I was 8 years old, but I'd heard stories that he'd come to Alcoholics Anonymous. So it was the last place I wanted to come. My whole life was driven on being a better person than me. And the resentments I had as a child, my whole life had just been completely driven to be a better person than him. And I end up that I have to turn up to the same place that he's probably been. And I go to this meeting in Red Hill, Reigate on a Sunday. And it's my first introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous. And some lady's up speaking. And she says about her mother being an alcoholic. She says that she was in a children's home. She talks about her drinking. And I'm crying like a baby in a meeting. I'm thinking, oh my God. Oh my God. And I have this rich, wealthy girlfriend with me, and I remember leaving the meeting, and John, who was a good friend of mine in recovery, said to me that there's another meeting on this day and here, and just tried to speak to him about it a little bit, and I said, yeah, this is amazing, I just can't believe it, and I'm crying, and I get in the car, and she's driving me down the road, and I get 10 minutes down the road, and I was said to her, why did you tell them about my children's home? Why did you tell them about my drinking? And I thought that you were all just conning. You were telling my story just to keep me for some reason. It was all just a massive con. And about a month later, I come back again. And sort of the same people were there. And that was the story of my life for a few years. I just kept coming back. You know, they said keep coming back. And I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with keep coming back. And I kept coming back. And then the problem with keep coming back is every time I relapse, because I've watched people relapse and die, I don't know what relapse that person's going to die in. It's okay to keep coming back. There's things we have to do in between coming back. And so I kept coming back, and I'd listen to stories of people. You know, like, there was one guy, an Irish guy who I know, and he spoke about hitting bottom, and his bottom was being dragged out by ambulance men holding a bottle of vodka, bleeding from every hole. And I'm sitting there in my suit, thinking, when I get that bad? When I get that bad, I might just do something about my drinking. And then I used to relapse and come back, and the girls would hug me and make me tea. I used to think, right, that blonde girl on a Tuesday, if I relapse on Monday, and get to that meeting on a Tuesday, she'll make me tea and give me a cuddle. Because no girls wanted to be around me when I was relapsing anyway. And everybody sort of just hugged me and cuddled me. And then I used to go into meetings and be very disruptive. It got to the state where I got very disruptive, and I'd throw chairs up and tell everyone to sit F off. And I remember a guy sharing, you know, that he was grateful for being an alcoholic. And I had to be held back outside the meeting because I wanted to kill him. I just couldn't understand why I want to be grateful. And then I hear people saying about the whole program's in our Just for Today card. So I thought, well, it's much easier to buy a Just for Today card for 20 pence than buy a big book for £8. So I bought the Just for Today cover. And I remember in March 2005, sitting in my kitchen, reading the Just for Today card, and having this feeling inside my belly, this feeling just real deep in here, this chum, and drinking and nothing happening anymore, and thinking that Alcoholics Anonymous might work for a lot of you, but it certainly ain't working for me. When I was growing up in Scotland, I was talking about this earlier, CIA? I was brought up in a Protestant religion, and I was brought up not to like people like him. And I used to go to the Catholic Church when I was a kid, and I used to go there for a couple of reasons. One was to urinate in the holy water that they dipped their fingers in, and the second one was to spray the grass orange or red, white, and blue. Or I used to catapult the windows in the church. And that was sort of how I grew up. In Scotland. And what happened that day in my kitchen is, you know, it was really funny. The address that I lived in when I got sober had a postal address, CRA 2AA. And I was about 6 months sober when I was ordering something on the internet, and I was like, put in my postcode. I was thinking, oh my God, God was telling me all the time, 2AA. I just remember very clearly in the kitchen and everything. I believed they even worked for me, and it seemed to be working for all of you. And what I did is I tried to take my life, and I meant it. You know, I did two silly attempts of trying to kill myself before. It was, I don't know if it was a cry for help. I don't really know what it was. I knew that when those things happened, everybody rallied around me and felt sorry for me. You know, but this time it was different. I wanted to take my life, and it didn't happen. And somebody found me, and I ended up in hospital, and they were spilling water everywhere. They tried to suture me. And they put a psychiatrist in front of me who was pretty young. And I conned that the girlfriend would be able to take me away and she'd look after me and everything would be fine. And I conned myself out of the hospital. I went back to the office where I worked as a funeral director. And somebody, there was a box about this big that had been a present for me for doing a funeral. And I knew it was in there. I could sense through the wrapping there was a bottle of whiskey in there. And I think if my secretary at the time had known what it was, she wanted to give it to me. And I remember taking it, I put it in the boot of my car, and I'm driving home, and I get to the top of the road, and I have two options. I can turn right and go home, or I can turn left and go somewhere. And this thought just came in my head, to go left. And I turned left, and God had placed me. When I look back, God had placed me all the way through my life. And what he'd done, he'd placed me as a funeral director. And being a funeral director, I've been around a lot of ministers, priests, churches, and God. And even though I don't like it, I'd been placed there. And to turn left was a Catholic church with a priest that I did most of the funerals in that church. The church just seemed to be attracted to me, not me attracted to it. And I drove outside the church, and the priest was coming out. And I just remember I had bandages on my wrist, and I said, look, please just take it. And he looked at the statement, and he said, oh my God. And I said, just take the whiskey. And I said, look, I don't know why, but I need to get in the church. And he had these big bunch of keys. And I remember, look, it was big doors like over here, and he's trying to get the key in the lock, and I'm thinking, please, just open the door. I don't know why. Just begging, please God, that door open. And the door opened, and what happened was, you know, like I shared earlier, was that many times I got on my knees in AA and asked for a sober day, and I drank. And this time, for some reason, it was different. And I didn't ask for a sober day. I got on my knees and I begged something I didn't believe in for help. And something happened to me. It never happened before. And I got off of my knees and I thought, right, that's it, I'll become a Catholic. Do you know what I mean? I need to become a Catholic. And I remember telling to who's one of my best spiritual advisors today is a priest called Father Joe, an Irish guy. And I remember saying to him, I think I want to become a Catholic. He said, Dave, maybe you should go back to AA. And I said, I've been to AA. they can't help me. You know, I've tried. And he said, but did you, have you ever had a sponsor? And I said, yeah, I've had sponsors. And I did. You know, there was a guy in the meeting who was 45 years sober. I thought, well, if I get him to sponsor me, he must know how to stay sober. He just told me to go to more meetings and not worry about the steps. This priest told me to go back to AA and get a sponsor to take the steps. And the reason he needed to do that is because he was a member of Al-Anon, and he lived with a priest who had been an alcoholic. Mm-hmm. And God had set me up. He was there all through my life, and I didn't know it, I didn't believe it, and I didn't want it. 3 months before that day in my kitchen, there was a guy who had started coming around the meetings that I went to, and he was a Canadian guy, and I hated him. You know, he was dressed well, he spoke about God, steps. I owed people a lot of money, you know, and he spoke about paying people back money. And the girls liked him. You know what I mean? He just seemed to, like, everywhere I went, he sort of attracted people. And I used to set the meetings for him in the water. Can't say the words, but you know. And I hated him. And what happened was, a few months before, somebody had given me his business card, and for some reason, loads of people in AA given me numbers and said, ring me. I never want to ring them. You know what I mean? There's nothing for me. And for some reason, I kept his card. And I took the priest's advice, and I rang him up. And I said, I need help. And he said to me, he told me where he lived. And he said, come round. And I said, when? He said, no. I said, no. He said, no. And I went to see him, and he said, are you working? And I said, yeah. He said, can you take any time off work? I said, yeah. He said, can you take 2 weeks off work? I said, yeah. And I rang him up and said, look, I'm sick. I mean, that's quite true. The first thing I ever said true to work was that I was sick. I said, I'm sick and I need 2 weeks off work. And what the man did was, he took me in. And he read me this beautiful book. And as he read me this book, I took the action that was been spoken about all day today. And somebody trusted me. And he knew what his primary purpose was, you know. And it was the first time I had eaten salad in 20 years. Because he used to make all these healthy food crap. You know, and he made me these meals, and he allowed me to sleep in a room in his house. And I remember there was a drawer open in the room. You know what has alcoholic, like, when nosy people, right? When, you know, I have to have a little snoop around to see what's there. And I remember there was a drawer open, and it was full of Rolex watches. And my first thought was, well, I'll have one of these. And then I thought, you know what I mean? I sat there in that bed and thought, that somebody trust me. You know, where I'd been and what things I'd done in my life. You know, I'd robbed everybody through my drinking. Not just of money, of peace of mind. And he trusted me. And what we did, we sat down. We went through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and he... And for the first time, all those years in AA, for the first time I got to learn. You know, I'd sat at meetings and said, my name's David, I'm an alcoholic, and I'd cry like a baby when I come back from a relapse. Or I'd sit in there and just spill all my crap, like people seem to do. And for the first time, I got to learn about my illness, you know, what had already been shared today as, you know, phenomenal craving and mental obsession and spiritual morality. I got to learn what it was that made me alcoholic. And, when I started to learn those things, I was then become willing to take the action that was outlined in a book. And I remember we got to step three. I was a couple of days sober by now. And he said, you know, we're going to take the step three prayer. And normally do it on our knees. And I can close the curtains. We can light a candle. We're going to say a little prayer afterwards. But don't get freaked out of that. And I was just thinking, oh my God, I know what it is now. He's gay. He wants me to get on my knees, he wants to close the cupboards, light a candle, and I actually believe that he might have his mates in the cupboard. And, you know, I took the risk. And I got on my knees and I said the third step prayer on my sponsor. And I felt a little bit lighter. You know, I don't know if no magical lights happened or anything, but I felt a little bit lighter. And then he said to me, right, the next line of our books, the next we launch in a course of vigorous action. He said, so now you're going to do your step four, Dave, and tomorrow we'll take your step five. I was like, I've been in A for years, man. Nobody does a step four at 2 or 3 days sober. You know what I mean? I know people 10 years that are not even thinking about doing one yet. And he said, let's go back to that line. Next we launch. Launch. It's like a rocket, Dave. Rockets don't hang around. Here's your pen. And he showed me how to do some columns and how to do inventory, and I did it. And you know, the truth is, did I get every single thing and resentment and fear and sexual conduct of my life on that first step four at 3 days sober? No, I didn't. I didn't. But a big book talks about stock and trade, and I can only trade what I have in stock at that time. And the stuff I needed to get rid of was the big stuff. You know, was the stuff that it was mainly about my father. And the fears about, you know, lots of different fears about paying all the money back to people, all the things that I thought I was really fearful of. And the next day I got up and had written it all, and we sat down and he said another silly little prayer that freaked me out a little bit, but he shared some stuff with me that he had done. And I was thinking, oh my God. That's really bad. And you know, the one thing that I the one thing that I had on there was this car crash, because it was the worst thing that I'd ever done in my life that I thought of. And as I'm reading my step four, so I'm crying like a baby as I'm getting to the place that I, you know, that we spoke about today, my car. And I just got to see what I was, you know, and I was a liar, a cheat, and a thief. All my life, all I ever did, to everybody I ever, anybody that ever came into contact with me, was all I ever did. And he said to me at the end, is there anything else? Because he said, I'll probably never know, but you will. And I had such relief in giving somebody all this stuff that I already had. I said, there's one more thing. And he gave me a pen, and I wrote it out. And because I don't want to go and make amends for this. You know what I mean? That's a fear. How do you do that? So we do that, and then he says, right, you can go home, you can do your 6 and 7, as outlined in the big book, you have an hour. This is your defects of character. You know, I remember going home, and my flat wasn't a great place by then, a lot of things had been smashed up, and you know, I had no shelf on the wall. A big book says that we take the book from the shelf. And I rang him up. I'm like, oh my God, I haven't got a shelf, and he's going to worry about it. And I spent an hour, exactly, to the second. And I wanted God to remove everything. I knew that if I was to keep any of this stuff, I'd drink it. And I don't want to drink again. And I remember getting on my knees and begging God to remove this stuff from me. And you know what? I got up off my knees, and for about 3 seconds, they were all gone. And then they started coming back. And they keep coming back. And constantly, there's things I have to do about that kind of thing. And I went back because they said, you need to come back with a list of your amends and your step eights. And the way I did it then, I did it many different ways. The way I did it when I was new was in 3 columns. The amends that I'm willing to do now, the ones that I'm willing to do another time, and the no effing ways. And I had most of them around the middle and the end column. And I took them around to my sponsor, and he changed them all for me. He said, maybe you can go and do these, and go and do those ones. And I had over 200 grand of financial amends. I had a lot of mates to me. You know, I was speaking to him, James earlier, it took my wife 3 years in recovery to speak to him, my ex-wife. 3 years, she wouldn't accept my ex. You know, I was able to sit down with my kids. I remember the first amends that I ever made to them. I remember sitting down and just saying, look, I want to be sober. You know, I'm trying my best, I'm doing it this time. Because I was excited about recovery this time. You know, I hadn't been excited before. And I remember sitting down with them and telling them, like, I'm sorry. And, you know, the things that I'm going to do to try and put it right. And I remember them bringing little note cards out to me and saying that they loved me on it. And thank me for certain things, and then I moved on, and you know, I had amends to make at work. My sponsor recommended probably about 3 years worth of amends, and I did that. You know, and I went out and started making my financial amends, and I did other stuff. And then he put me on step 10, and he said, look, I want to call you. You need to call me every night at 10 o'clock, and I want your inventory. He said, you miss one, you start again. Was just like, right. And what I learned from that was it got me to keep on writing, it got me to keep it clean, and it got me that I was going to meet 10 o'clock because I didn't want to start it again. You know what I mean? And then he said, step 11 is very clear, Dave. You know, you can really do what you like, but it's all written down in a beautiful book. And what I've done over a period of time is I've gone out and searched other things. You know, I've gone to churches and I've did other things, and they've been exciting and helpful, and I've read other books. I get bored of that stuff pretty quick, and I always end up coming back to our book and the stuff that's in our book. And step 12 was been very, very powerful for me. You know, I was 3 months sober when somebody asked me to help them, and my sponsor said, well, you've been through the steps, go and do it. And what happened was, in AA where I am, was I was angry when I nearly got sober. You know, I was joyful and excited about recovery. I was also very angry because a lot of members had said to me, just go to meetings and don't worry about the steps. Just don't drink. Just don't take that first drink. I could not help not take that first drink. I went to lots of meetings. I still got drunk. And I was very angry. And I went around Alcoholics Anonymous hitting people over the head with big books. Not literally, but sharing it quite. And this sponsee came, and I was like, I did everything to try and keep him sober. Because I thought, if I keep him sober, and he keeps somebody else sober, and then I've got a little army behind me, then everybody will believe in me. And I'll be this really powerful guy in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was right. Because it is all out of the big book. But other things work for other people, and I have to respect that. You know, but also what I have to do is be true to me, and true to what the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is about. And then over the years, I've sponsored quite a lot of people, you know, and I do that because it's a gift. You know, the big book says that I have been given the power to help others. What a promise. You know, from come from where I've come from to be given the power to help others. It's just amazing. And then what I suppose it's like today is it's actually quite amazing today. You know, the financial amends and stuff I did with where I used to work, I did the 3 years, and the company that I worked for got taken over by somebody else. It was a family member who was only interested in money and prestige, and I decided that I couldn't work that way. You know, AA taught me a different way of life. It taught me to be of love and service to others. How can you be in the job I'm doing as a funeral director and only care about the money? Has to be a quality of love and service, what AA taught me. So I decide, with no money, that I'm going to open up my own funeral directors. I think when I told Kim, she really freaked out. And what happened was two things happened. For 3 years that I had been in recovery, I had an aunt who wouldn't speak to me. But my mother, she'd been asking my mother, how's David doing? She'd say, great, he's doing this now, and he's doing this. And she'd obviously, over 3 years, tell him all the things that I'm doing now, Alcoholics Anonymous, how good I am, blah, blah, blah. I got a phone call out of the blue that I needed £40,000 to open this business. I signed the heads of terms of release overdrawn in the bank account for $150,000. And I signed it because I knew I was meant to do it. And what happened was, an aunt who I had owed money to from financial mentor who wouldn't speak to me, rang me and said that, "I know what you've been doing in Alcoholics Anonymous. I know how you're trying to build your life. And I want to help you." And she said, "I know you need £40,000. I'm willing to give you 20. Will that help?" I was like, "Oh my God." And then I came home and Kim said, "Look at the newspaper. Front page, headline, local newspaper. Croydon Business Ventures, willing to give new business startups £20,000. And I went, "Oh my God." And then for a couple of weeks, I thought, "I'm not worthy of that," you know, and I didn't apply for it. And Kim said to me, "If you apply for that thing," and I was, "No." And then I applied for it and I got it and started my business. And, you know, I've had it 5 years now. You know, but these are things that I was just incapable of doing, you know, completely incapable. In the process of that business, I had financial amends to the British government for some overdue taxes, which I ignored a little while in recovery, because they weren't really going to come looking for me, because the last time they came looking for me, I had a suicide attempt, and they didn't really want to push me over the edge. So I sort of held back on that one for a little while, and then they came after me in recovery, and they wanted $120,000, and I just started this business, and they told me again that I was to do the right thing, and Kim bought the business back legally for the right price, and I went through bankruptcy and recovery. And I remember going to the receiver, and they said, "We've looked at your finances, and in 6 months you'll be written off. You don't have to pay anything." And I remember my sponsor's word before I'm in there saying, "Dave, whatever they say, you owe the money. It's not your money, it's their money." And I'm sitting there with this receiver, and I'm saying to him, "I need to pay the money back." And he's like, "You haven't got any money to pay back." I said, "I know, but I need to at least start paying something back." And he said, "Well, we can't see where you come." And I said, "Look, I need to." And then I disclosed that I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, "And I need to pay this money back, because if I don't pay it back, I believe I'll drink." And he said, "We have loads of people come through that bankrupt in Alcoholics Anonymous. None of them ever pays the money back." And I said, "I don't really care about anybody else. I have to do this for me." And we agreed a monthly amount, and I was able to start paying it back. Yeah, I've had amazing things happen to me. You know, my children, I love them dearly today. You know, I've spent a lot of time watching my son play football, who is in a football academy. He's really good football. I've been able to watch him, be proud, be supportive, not push him too much, let him find his own experience in that. And then he found his own experience about a year and a half ago, where he thought that smoking some funny stuff and porn on the internet was going to be his solution. And his mother rang me, you know, somebody that took 3 years to speak to me, rang me for advice on how to treat him. And actually came round to me and Kim's house with her partner and sat there and took advice off of me on how to bring her son up. That's a miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. Doesn't make me a superhuman great AA guy. What it makes is that this program works. You know, to watch, I remember when she left, we were both sitting and I was looking and just going, "Oh my God." You know? Every week, I have never once in recovery not paid my dues for my kids, because I was taught that I paid my way. Yet every Friday when the money's due, she still texts me and says, "Don't forget my money." But I never forget, because you guys taught me to pay my way, to pay my own way. And I've had ups and downs too. You know, I've had deaths in my family. You know, I got to go and make amends to a grandfather while he was dying in hospital and tell him that I loved him. I don't really know if I did, but I did it for him. You know, I got to meet my father in recovery. You know, the first meeting that I ever went to was a meeting in London, at South London, that was a home group of his. I mean, how mad is that? When I took my step five, I had a phone call anonymously from my father, who knew I was an AA, and he called me to meet me. And the first thing he asked me, he says, "What do you do for a living?" I said, "I'm a funeral director." And he laughed his head off. Because all my family in Scotland have been doing funerals for over 100 years, and I never even knew. That side of the family had been taken away from us as a child, and I didn't know. You know, I went to be a funeral director to carry coffins for enough money to drink. If that's not God, and that's not the program of Alcoholics Anonymous working in my life. And then I got my father came to where we lived, and he lived for about a year and a half. And you know, by this time I had helped start some groups because I decided, I remember coming back from meetings, here's the truth. And I rang my sponsor up, and I was like, "Oh, those, they're not carrying the message of AA, do you know what I mean? And I never got anything out of that meeting, they're all just sharing about all their problems. Ease, but rebuke." And he said, "Look, Dave, if you don't like it, start meeting yourself." Do you know what I mean? He said, "Some of the best meetings in the world would be started by resenting the coffee pot." And I got involved in starting this group. And so my dad comes, and I think I must have been about a year sober maybe, when he came to live up above me in the flat above. And he was an AA, or so he said. There was a lot of things happened. What it did for me was open a door, which I hasn't done for my brothers and sisters, and I've been able to see him for what he is. I have no emotional ties with mine whatsoever, and be able to say, you know, thanks God for the experience, but I don't want him to be part of my life. You know, he doesn't live the AA program that I live. You know, there's certain things he did, but that's no big deal. I remember he came to my home group, and you know, here's a group that his sons helped start. And 5 minutes into the meeting, he gets up and says, "This is no FNA meeting," and walks out. I don't want him to be that in my life. You know what I mean? I have enough respect for myself today that if you don't do certain things in my life, I no disrespect to you, but I don't need you in my life. You know, I'm okay how I am with you, okay within me and myself. And I love Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I love it at its core. I love it when I think back of Bill and Bob being the two people that started this thing. And that's where, for me, you know, there's been a lot of talk about service and a lot of different things. For me, in my experience, I'm not good at that stuff. I'm not good at going to inner group. I'm not good at going and getting involved in that stuff. And although people are, at its core for me, and how it works and what I'm good at, is I'm good at carrying a message to somebody else. You know, and that's what I stick at. I don't try and push myself in any for things that are unachievable for me. I just love sitting down one-to-one with somebody else, like my sponsor did with me. You know, and recently I've changed my sponsor. I had one of those moments, you know, one of those God moments when somebody's sitting with you and they're talking to you, and they know you know, and you know they know, and you know that they're sharing something that's just happening in your life. And I'm sharing things about how I feel about AA, how I feel about meetings in AA, how I feel about my wife, how I feel about all these things. And he's going, "Yeah, Dave, me too, 10 years ago. Yeah, Dave, me, I did that 10 years ago. Yeah, Dave, I did that 10 years ago." And I'm sitting there and I'm crying again. And I just know that God had placed it in my path for me to learn and have a new experience with Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I remember saying to him, will you, it's like when I was new, you don't really want to ask the sponsor, you sort of go around about it, you know what I mean? Like, it's like when somebody's asking me, they sort of, I've never then they really come out and ask me, "Will you sponsor me?" straight away. It's like a roundabout, "Where are you busy? Have you got time? Is any of your sponsees got time?" And that's what I did with him. I was going around it, and then eventually I just said, "Will you help me?" And he said, "Yeah, fine, 60-day trial." you know, ring me every day. These are the three areas of your life I want you to talk to me about on the phone. And the only time that worked for me was to get up early in the morning and ring them at 6:30 UK time every morning. And I've done that, I think, for maybe about 30 days, and it's been absolutely amazing. You know, I started to go have a new experience with alcoholism and that. You know, and I got married, and again, pretty new, mm-hmm. must be said. I remember people saying to me, you shouldn't do it. When I was relapsing, I remember going to a meeting and Kim was speaking it when she was in that 4 years of dryness. I remember her talking in the group, and she had long hair and biker boots then and things, and I'm looking at her, I'm in a suit, come from work, and I'm thinking she's absolutely crazy. And I got halfway through her talk, I got up and left, and somebody came out after me outside the meeting and said, look, come back in. And I was like, oh, I'm going to pub. And he said, well, just come back in and hear the rest of the talk. I said, no, she's nuts. Absolutely nuts. And then a year and a half later, I was married. And although that's worked so far, it's been nice, really. But we have a boy, Evan. And I remember when we were due to get married and Kim found out she was pregnant. I don't know how that happened, but it happened. And Evan was due on the 13th of December. 11th of December. And I was just like, oh my God, please, God, let him be born on the 11th of December. Because that's when Bill had his last drink. And all the way through her pregnancy, I wasn't concerned about her at all. I was just like, I want this baby, he's got to be born in December, the 11th. And he wasn't, and he was born on the 12th. And we got a 12 by 12 baby. 12 steps, 12 traditions. And you know what? That boy has grown up in, you know, we was up Charlotte. We was talking the other day, my Doberman knows so many step fives. And my son must do too. And I watch him go to school and I watch him interact with others, and he has something in him that I never had as a kid. And that's A. He might be one of us, I don't know. But A works in his life. You know, I watch it in my other kids. It just seems to work. You know, he has just something about him that is a miracle. You know what I mean? He walks off to school and he has no fear and he interacts with other kids fine. And I just watch that. And I just what a gift. A gift to be awake to that. And then I've had to deal with the guilt I felt about my other son, who I walked away from. You know, I have the rest of my life to put that right. You know, and if I stay here with you and do what you taught me to do, and for me to be on the front line, you know what I mean? There's too many of us die. There's too many of us die that get here and don't hear the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. The message of Alcoholics Anonymous, its core, it's very simple, is that you get a book, a blue one, not a green one. The Blue Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you sit down with somebody who's suffering and you give them the option to do what you did. And then what I've learned through that is if they can pick up those kit of spiritual tools that were laid at my feet, they can get this miracle too. I am a miracle. Alcoholics Anonymous is the miracle. So yeah. I ain't got no more. I just love being a small part of a great whole. Thanks a lot.